A vague disclaimer is no one's friend. This podcast will look at episodes in relation to Buffy and Angel as a whole, and therefore contains spoilers for the entirety of both series. If you haven't seen all of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel the series, go and watch them before you listen to this. Remember, you've been warned.
The hardest thing in this world is to live in it.
That's why there's us, champions. We live as though the world were as it should be, to show it what it can be.
The Earth is definitely doomed.
It's Tuesday, so it must be time to return to the Hellmouth. We're going through the Buffyverse episode by episode in a look back at Joss Whedon's iconic show. I'm MC, and I'm here with...
This is Andy.
And this is David.
Okay, so this week is The Puppet Show. It's episode 9 of season 1. It originally aired May 5th, 1997. It was directed by Ellen S. Pressman, which I think is the first woman we've had direct a Buffy episode.
Yes.
And it was written by Rob Deshotel and Dean Patali, who are returning after a couple episodes. I can't remember the... I think the last one they did was Never Kill a Boy on the First Date.
That is correct. It is Never Kill a Boy on the First Date.
Yes. Of course, they were also, I believe, story editors at this point.
Yeah, I think for the first season. I don't think they might have stayed through season two, but I don't think they stayed on much after that.
No, because they moved over to, I think we talked about it before, they moved over to That 70s Show. Or that was a little later.
Yeah. Actually, I don't think we did talk about that.
Oh, I thought we did.
That's
but yeah,
knowledge.
They were showrunners on That 70s Show.
Oh, cool. So this episode is The Puppet Show, which in rewatching it, I'm surprised by how much I liked it.
Oh, I love this episode. Yeah, it's very charming.
Yeah, I mean, it's a one-off. It's nothing big. It's not earth-shattering. But I actually really like how everything works in this episode. I like all of the characters. And by all of the characters, I mean all of the characters. I'm like, oh my god, this is an episode where I don't hate Xander.
I know, right? Me too! I was very excited about my non-hatred of Xander, because he doesn't have a lot to do.
Well, yeah.
And also, they give a lot of the troublesome stuff to a puppet.
True. They give all of Xander's lines to Sid the Puppet.
Basically, yes.
Honestly, it didn't bother me so much.
Well, that's no, great. That's like... That's like how, you know, if you do an animated show, you can get away with a lot more than you can if you do a live action show.
That's very true.
It's like, give the horrible lines to the puppet.
Yeah. But I mean,
and
like...
even the puppet's lines weren't that bad. He was just a lech.
Yeah.
Yes, you know. Exactly.
And even though Xander's part wasn't very big, I feel like everybody did have a thing to do. Like, actually, if you're watching, like, the end scene, it's like, wow, like, it's not just Buffy kicking ass. Like, I mean, she is kicking ass, but Xander is involved and Willow's involved. And okay, Giles is kind of playing the damsel in distress, but, you know, he has contributed in his Giles way up until then. This is kind of one of the first episodes where it's like, wow, they're starting to work as a group.
Yes, that is one thing I absolutely noticed. I put that in my notes. I'm like, they really solidify their team building and bonding in this episode. I love the scene sort of at the beginning where the kids are all razzing Giles.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's so cute. And it really does set up that dynamic that we'll be seeing, you know, throughout the whole series. And like, Giles secretly loves everybody. You know, he's secretly like, oh, you horrible children and your mim, you know. But,
yes,
you know, I think he's secretly like, all right, these kids are okay. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's just, I think that first scene is very, very, very cute.
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And of course, very important in that their mocking of the talent show is almost immediately thwarted by the appearance of an important new character.
Yes.
Oh, yes, Principal Snyder, played by Armin Shimmerman, who, can I please go on about how much I love Armin Shimmerman?
Oh, he's wonderful.
Actually, everything.
You know, I know he's been in everything. This is really the only thing I'm really familiar with him in, but he is so wonderful.
Oh, I'm a huge Trekkie, so I'm very familiar with Armin Shimmerman.
I know, but I'm not.
Yeah,
so I, like, yeah.
Yeah, but he is one of these actors who has really kind of flown under the radar, I think mostly because he is known for Star Trek, and he's known for being under prosthetics in Star Trek. But every right. time he appears in something, he's always really good, and his role as Snyder, he's so good in it. And also, he was doing Buffy while he was doing his stuff on Star Trek. I think that was it was around the same time as Deep Space Nine. Like, so he was pulling a lot of double duty there. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah, he's one of those actors that, you know, he's a that guy.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. I'm looking it up. He was still, because Deep Space Nine ran till 1999. Mm-hmm. So he was doing that series still at the time. And
basically up until the time he got eaten on Buffy.
Yes, which I love. I happen to love here where he keeps going on about how that's the kind of woolly-headed thinking that leads to being eaten. And it's like, and saying that, you know, Principal Flutie was so lax and that's why he got eaten.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, boy, you're going to get eaten too. So,
which I think is great. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure at the time it wasn't foresight. Right, they weren't like, oh, we'll make sure this guy gets eaten later to continue the joke.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think that maybe when they got there to season three and sort of planned that climax, they're like, okay, we got it. We have to let the mayor eat Principal Snyder just to bring it full circle. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I just have a smile on my face thinking about Principal Snyder because he's just such a cool, I mean, he's horrible.
Yeah.
And you hate him so much, but like, it's the best kind of hatred. It's a gleeful hatred of like, yeah, this guy is great, great. Keep being awful.
Well, he's horrible, but he's so funny.
I know. Yeah.
And of course, speaking of funny, we've missed out on the most important part in this opening scene. And that is Cordelia singing Whitney Houston's The Greatest Love of All.
Because it's a song about personal hygiene, which is exactly what Whitney Houston meant when she sang the song.
Of course. Now, I have a note here saying confidence is not Cordy's problem. Her confidence is everyone else's problem.
Yeah. And then they actually call back to this moment. This must be Cordelia's favorite song because on Angel, when she has to sing for Lorne, she ends up singing the song and slouching towards Bethlehem, and she hasn't gotten any better.
Nope. No, she hasn't. I put it in my notes that, you know, Cordelia is on fire in this episode. She's just a gift that just peppers through the episode in a way we haven't seen that character really fully peppered through an episode. It's usually like she comes in one scene, says something mean, walks off. That's what we see of, you know, charisma for the week. But this one, she's sort of, you know, because she said, I can't have people judging me like I'm some kind of Buffy.
Yes.
Another great line. Go ahead.
And the bit where Xander is talking to her about Emily is just, I mean, it's one time where, you know, I mean, Xander, for all the, you know, horrible things we say about him, it's like, we don't usually see him as a murderer. And I really think he is just on the verge of just snapping and strangling her throughout that entire scene.
She's like, Emma was my best friend.
Yes. Yeah. You know, and the great thing is he goes, Emily, and we don't even get a whatever from Cordy. She just keeps going.
She goes into how it could have been her.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I definitely think one of the really great things about this episode is that you can feel things starting to click into place. What will carry through into the next season. And basically all of the seasons of them in the high school. They've really started to develop their dynamic in this episode, I really think.
Yeah, the characters are starting to gel.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it gives us a real taste of what this show's going to be like and really where it's heading in that sort of genre flipping, putting everything in. I mean, because who would think an episode about a ventriloquist dummy would work so well, but I think it gives the audience really a sense of, oh, so this is what this show is.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm.
And there are moments where you genuinely feel for Sid the puppet, mm-hmm. and you genuinely feel for Morgan, but it's also really funny because it's a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. Cordelia's hilarious. And then the team is really working well together, including the end, where Xander is the one that saves Giles while Buffy fights the bad guy.
Not just Xander, but also Willow, and because Willow she's wielding also. That. Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and this is, I think, the first episode where we really get twists in the main storyline. Oh, I guess the witch had it as well, but we get multiple twists in this one, mm-hmm. because it's like, mm-hmm. oh, it's Sid, oh, it's Morgan, oh no, it's Mark, and it's a demon. And
like, right.
They really do well playing, you know who's actually the one who did it. There was mm-hmm. a real proper mystery here that you don't find out until the end, and Mark has not been a huge part of the episode, but he has been in it throughout the entire thing. And so it's like, oh, okay.
Although yeah. I do have a sort of a production note for them. It's, you know, it opens with that sort of point of view shot of the demon saying, you know, I shall be whole and yeah. all that, and going and looking at all the participants. And it's really structured as a point of view shot. But I was going, wait, whose point of view is it? Because Mark's in that shot.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Huh. Okay. Well, that's a bobble.
Yeah. I'm sort yeah. of like, I mean, I kind of know what the mood they were trying to set with that, but from a technical standpoint, it's like, no,
that's lying. He
should not be there. Yeah. That's, yeah, mm-hmm. That is, yeah. that goes beyond unreliable narrator. That's into, like, out and out, we are lying to you.
Yeah. I did mm-hmm. not notice that. But yeah, totally. That's bullshit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Damn you, Joss Whedon.
Just
or whoever directed the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, for not kind of catching that, but
I have a couple yeah. of notes on fashion that I need to bring up because they come at the very beginning of the episode. Willow's rubber ducky shirt really stood out to me. I don't know if I like it or not. Because certainly I know, I mean, this was kind of before the ironic t-shirt like came into prominence. And certainly I know people that would wear a rubber ducky shirt now. But it really stood out to me. And then also, in, like, the next scene, Willow's wearing a striped shirt with dotted pants. And it is, like, the most clashy thing to ever clash. And I really needed to say, I don't know what was up with the costumer and Willow's outfits for this episode.
Yeah.
Maybe they were still trying to make Willow not fit in? I don't know. That's the only thing I can think of.
I mean, I remember a bit of the clashy patterns back in the 90s, but yeah. yeah, it was, yeah, I mean, the rubber ducky shirt is, you know, quite cute, mm-hmm. I think, but yeah, the pants, my partner was sitting next to me and said, is she wearing a Freddy Krueger shirt? Because of the color blend, he yeah. couldn't quite see that there were multiple colors, and he thought it just looked like a, you know, a red and green shirt that he thought she looked like Freddy Krueger yeah. was his comment on Willow's fashion. So it did stand out if someone randomly sitting next to me notices the bad fashion.
Yeah, no, because I mean, it was like this red and green and orange and yellow striped shirt. And then, like, blue and green dotted pants. And so it's like, Willow, did you get dressed in the dark? Like, seriously, how did you think this was a good look?
Well, and Willow has some crazy looks, of course. She yeah. knows, she's known for the crazy birthday cake shirt, but it's a lot more purposeful, I think.
Yeah.
As a character choice instead of just ugly. But I did read something that talked about how the clothes changed between season one and season two.
Yeah.
And even to middle of season two, they really improve. It's because Sarah was like, no. And she asked for more labels and better fashion. So she sort of took it on herself as the star of the show to say, yeah, this stuff, this isn't really that fashionable. So I would really like you to get me some fashionable clothes. Mm-hmm. And the costume designers agreed. And that's why everybody starts looking a little more spiffy come season two. So that's just a small trivia note.
Buffy, her explanation as to why she finds dummies creepy. I love it. I love that there's no reason for it.
Yeah, no, there's no story there. I just, dummies creep me out.
Yeah, and really, you don't need an actual reason. It's like, because, dummies are pretty creepy. And Sid, in particular, is very creepy. In that, you know, how do those eyebrows and eyes move? Like, right, I mean, we know, but, you know. There's no way that Morgan would be able to manipulate that if Sid were an actual dummy.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, right. So that's got to be something of his mystical nature.
Yeah.
Right.
That everything moves like that. Dummies are probably one of the scariest things. And, like, all I can think of through that this episode is that terrible comedian with the stupid ventriloquist dummies, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who I'm usually forced to watch at holidays with my in-laws. What is his name? Jeff Dunham? Jeff Dunham with his, you know, he's evil in his banal racial insensitivity. So he's not a good guy like Sid. That's my creepy dummies hatred coming out.
Yeah. The thing about Sid that kind of gets me is that his behavior is kind of inconsistent. It's like, you think if he's hunting demons, he and Morgan would have some kind of understanding of like stealth. and the way they play it, it's like, first, you know, Morgan, they start with Morgan doing bad ventriloquism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, or actually not doing ventriloquism at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he's literally just talking.
Yeah.
And then Sid takes over. And it's like, really? Did you guys not plan this out?
I'm trying to figure out how exactly this whole team up actually happened. Like,
yeah, that too.
Yeah, like, how did Morgan end up getting Sid? Like, did he just like buy Sid at a shop or something? Why would Sid be there? Like, how did this work out? Like, did Sid come up to Morgan and it's like, hey, I know I'm a living puppet, but can you take me into your school? I need to find a demon. Because, I mean, obviously Morgan knows what's going on. He's talking to Sid.
Although the first time in the first scene we see them, he actually looks surprised when Sid takes over. So it's not a consistent performance. It's not consistently written. Mm-hmm. I find that a little odd because the episode overall is nicely put together, but that aspect of it seems like they gave no thought to.
I think my headcanon on that, now that I'm thinking about it, is Morgan's got brain cancer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe he thinks the dummy talking to him is a symptom of his cancer, which can cause hallucinations, personality changes, lots of that different kind of thing.
Yeah. But there are definitely times when he's like, Sid would wait for me. Like, he is very convinced that Sid is animate.
I think, actually, like, it never bothered me before that they don't really establish the backstory between Morgan and Sid. It's only kind of when I'm going back and really, like, watching, you know, under the microscope.
Mm.
And so I think for, you know, like, a everyday viewer, they'll think it's fine, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you could come up with the idea that Sid, you know, figured out some way to infiltrate, like, Morgan wanted to, like, do a ventriloquist act, so he bought a dummy, and Sid, like, arranged to have himself there or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not so much the backstory that bothers me, it's the execution.
Yeah.
Once they're together.
Yeah.
It's like, they really just pay no attention to trying to make Sid look like a puppet. I mean, like, Sid just does stuff where he's just clearly, like, taking over.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, Yeah. That's not a good plan.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe, like, that time, like, in the first scene that we see them in, where Sid starts talking, maybe that's the first time Morgan has heard Sid talk, and then there's an explanation later on that we don't see, because Morgan has still got to be set up to be bad guy.
I could see that. Yeah. I mean, the other thing with Morgan that I have a problem with is, given the whole brain cancer thing, like, why is he not being apparently treated?
Yeah, that is sort of bothersome to me.
I mean, like, there is no indication that they're doing anything about his brain cancer. Yeah.
Well, the thing that bothered me the most about it was the fact that his teacher did not know. If he has been out of school for half the year, and it is in his school medical records, his teacher would know.
Right.
And so she's like, well, you know, you've seemed so far away. And I was like, well, of course he seems so far away. You know, this is what's happening to him.
And also the protocols for treatment of brain cancer. I'm sorry, that kid's not in school. That he's just not. I am currently interning at a comprehensive cancer center. So this, I see this every day. The kid's not in school. That's just not a place he can be right now, unless he's in remission, and he's not.
He's obviously not.
He's clearly not.
And he's not. He would be, at the place where he is with his cancer, he'd be doing palliative care and pain management. So, you know, but hey, I know things about that.
Well, yes.
Unfortunately, I do as well, so.
Yeah, for sure.
As do I, yeah. It's not, you know, but the thing is, it's like, I think even the most not knowledgeable person would go, oh, brain cancer, that's really serious.
Yeah.
And you don't just, like, live your normal life while you've got brain cancer.
Which will come back around to in season 5.
We'll come back to it in season 2. Yeah, brain cancer is, well, they go to a lot. I actually have noticed.
No, that's true. Wow, our fun little episode turned into a conversation about really serious things, and that's okay.
Yeah. Actually, the thing that's most frustrating for me is that overall, this is really kind of a, maybe charming is the wrong word, but it's really just a nice episode.
Yeah.
It is a nice episode, and I really go ahead.
Yeah, but there are just these, like, certain things that are just really just, like, big things that pop up, and you go, what?
Well,
you know.
I was very curious about the dancer-band rivalry.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite lines, is, you know about that dancer-band rivalry, and Buffy's like, okay.
And I'm
I've heard about that.
I've heard about that. Besides some of these little problems that we're talking about, it does have some really great jokes.
Yeah.
And I really like all the red herrings going along that we don't quite know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, first we think, Buffy thinks it's Morgan to start with.
Yeah.
Morgan, and then Sid.
Buffy.
And Sid thinks it's Buffy, and then they find out. And then Well, and then they really set that up as it's Principal Snyder.
They do set up some Principal Snyder.
There is. Yeah, there is that one scene where, like, Giles sees Principal Snyder in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, the only reason that scene is there is to make you think it's Snyder.
Yeah, and there's all of these scenes with Snyder kind of lurking, and it's like, what are you doing here, you know, after hours? So,
But, and he's a brand new character, and we haven't seen him, and he seems pretty darn evil, which he kind of is in a great way. Yeah. But, so I think it's really set up, like, you're like, okay, it's not this kid, and it's not the dummy, he's a good guy. Oh, it's this evil little Ferengi-looking guy that many of us recognize from Star Trek. It's gotta be him.
Yeah.
Right.
It's gotta be him.
And of course, it turns out to be the kid that has had basically no significance whatsoever over anyone else in the episode. Yeah. He just happens to be one of the kids in the talent show.
Yeah, and he's had a couple of scenes. They do kind of set him up as a character, but it is kind of, you know, the butler did it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And also, one thing I have to say about him, when he does finally, when he reverts to his demon form, I think up to this point, this is like one of the better realizations of a costume, because it really does look like the picture in the book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all inconsistent with that. So I'm like, points for that, guys.
That's... And the way they actually set up his transformation, they have Buffy punch him and like part of his skin comes away and she's like, ew.
Yeah.
And then she locks him in the box and then he comes out of the box as the demon. It's like, that's a really nice reveal.
Yeah.
I actually remember that very clearly when Buffy first started. The Toronto Star TV guide that, you know, like came every Saturday or whatever, they did an article on Buffy, and I clearly remember the promo shot they used was of Buffy from this episode with the demon Mark's arms coming out of the box. And that's just always something that has stuck with me, so.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, the great strength of this episode is that it's, I think it breaks all records for number of red herrings, and the red herrings are handled incredibly well. The development of one to the next, to the next, to the next, just really works, because they're all plausible, and the reasons that it turns out that they're not the killer are plausible.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not like the typical red herring thing where half the time you're like, yeah, it was kind of, I knew it wasn't that guy.
Yeah. And of course, they have the great line as, does anybody else feel like they've been Kaiser Soze'd?
Which I have that in my notes. Yeah. Which I wrote a whole thing about, you know, again, I think we talked about this before, of that new use of language and vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, the Kaiser Soze, they're verbing a noun.
Yeah.
Right. And it, I have been accused many times of talking like I'm a Buffy character. I don't even know where that comes. What? But it's funny because it's people around my age or a little bit older that watched the show when it originally came out. But younger people that I know that are now discovering the show or discovered a few years ago, people in their, you know, late teens and early 20s, they think nothing of the way I sort of, and I don't think it's an affectation. I think it's just seeped in there over years.
Oh, yeah.
Because they talk like that, too. They verbify things. And these are kids that have either never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer or saw it really late in their life and it already talked like that. Mm-hmm. So again, one of the revolutionary things about Buffy and one of the reasons I love it so much is that real play on language, which I think probably really appealed to me then and certainly appeals to me now. So
yeah, it certainly contributed to popular slang. I mean, the thing where Buffy says, yeah, I saw a dummy and it gave me the wig. It's like the whole, like, the Wiggins thing. Like, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when nobody said that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I mean, for me, it clearly comes from Buffy.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of, like, just terms and language that, for me, is like, no, obviously, I first saw this on Buffy.
Mm-hmm.
And it wormed its way into the language.
I do remember the term Wiggins being used before Buffy.
Okay.
Because I just remember.
Well, but I assumed it came from somewhere. Yeah. I mean, it didn't actually originate in Buffy. But I think it was sort of a chicken egg thing, like with Joss and the other writers seeing these terms being used a bit and then taking them and putting them in the show, which intensified their real world usage.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you listen to Joss Whedon talk, a lot of this cadence and rhythm is Joss. I mean, he does speak that way. He does make up kooky words, and which is great. One of the reasons I love Joss and love this show, because it has such a lasting impact on our culture, hence the reason we're talking about this 20 years later.
Yeah, and I think some of the other writers that we'll get onto the show, some of, like, the really notable ones like Jane Espenson, Drew Goddard, mm-hmm. you also hear kind of the same sort of voice with them, which is, I think, probably mm-hmm. how they ended up getting the job on the show in the first place. And that just kind of attracted people that had like that Buffy voice kind of as an everyday thing.
Yeah, I think as the show gained popularity, Joss sort of took that the power that gave him and brought in people of his mindset and language.
Yeah.
And Joss, I have to say, I this on the DVD set, this is the disc now, we just now get to the disc, where there's the interview with Joss about Angel and the puppet show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at Joss, I'm like, you look like you're like 15 years old. Yeah. You're just like way too young.
I think he was 15 years old.
How old was he though in this 30-something?
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds about right. He already had a career.
Yeah.
At this point.
Right.
He was born in 64, so
he's my age.
Yeah.
So he was 30 something, yeah.
Yeah. Right, 32. So, yeah, 32.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So, yeah, and of course in that interview he also covers the origin of the company name Mutant Enemy.
Mhm. That was his typewriter, wasn't it?
That was his typewriter, but the thing he doesn't mention, and which I find kind of odd, is that you would go, okay, well, why would you name your typewriter or anything Mutant Enemy? And of course, those of us who are infected with the prog rock bug, we know that Mutant Enemy is actually a phrase from the Yes song And You and I.
Oh, really?
Yes. So that's, and I have seen it confirmed in various sources that is in fact where Joss got the term for his typewriter.
Oh, cool.
So,
that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
I know a few songs by Yes. Mm-hmm. I was never much of a prog rocker, but I appreciate the trivia, which I will now bury in my brain for trivia night at the pub.
I live to serve.
I will now win me free drinks with that information, so thank you.
Okay.
My pleasure.
So, we might have to chalk this up to the Hellmouth, but there's a murder, and they don't cancel the talent show. And then there is also, there is a murder, and Joyce is asking Buffy, is something wrong? You know, something seems to be bothering you.
Oh, God, yes, that's right.
Does she know? Did they even call the parents?
There was a murder on campus.
Yeah, but it's Sunnydale.
But there's some murder on campus every day or so.
I mean, it's just, this is why it has to be chalked up to the Hellmouth. But
always.
This was a definitive murder. Like, I mean, there's like a murder weapon and everything. Like, there was a suicide on campus. Right. And there have been people that have, you know, disappeared or whatever. And even that, up to this point, I don't think anybody's actually, you know, like, been killed, like, except for, like, the first episode. There's not been a student who's been, like, killed actually on campus.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, I just feel like it would be, I guess we're now getting to the point where this stuff is just going to be, you know, hand-waved. You know, there's no more, you know, trauma counselors coming in
I think if they notified every parent of every murder, every kid would no longer be going to Sunnydale High School, but you know,
right. But I mean, at various times through the series, they do point out that people just kind of
hand wave things away.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they do it in the pilot.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, Xander's like, oh, my God, tomorrow we're going to go to school. And what's it going to be like? And it's exactly the same scene as the opening of the show.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what's going on? And Giles says, well, people, you know, they work these things out in their heads. And
they rationalize the things.
They rationalize things. That was the word.
They rationalize the things they can and forget the things they can't.
Right.
If I'm. If I remember correctly, like, this is something that does come up a lot in these types of shows, and enough that it's actually a trope on TV Tropes, and it was originally called Sunnydale Syndrome. I don't think it is anymore.
Okay. But, I mean, that's, and the interesting thing will be when we get to the end of season three, and we get the admission at the prom that
the kids
people actually do remember.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it, they don't think about it, but they really know that stuff is going on, and they know that there are people protecting them.
I'm just thinking about, in Once More with Feeling, when Xander is looking at the newspaper, and the headline says, you know, like, everybody's singing, officials say demons definitely not to blame.
Which is basically the entire town of Sunnydale, right? And obviously, in a show like this, you have to just chalk it up to the Hellmouth and you have to hand wave it, because you can't spend, you know, three quarters of your episode having your parent deal with your the latest letter from the school that says, hey, we had a murder.
Yeah. It just really stuck out to me. It's like, if Joyce hadn't mentioned it at all, but the fact that she was just like, is there something bothering you, Buffy? And it's like, well, yeah, of course, you know, there's stuff bothering her.
Right.
But guess what?
I did like that Joyce was trying to be supportive and she wanted to go to the talent show.
Yeah, I did have the thought that it's like, wow, this is the best mothering Joyce has actually done since we've started the show.
And, you know, I'm keeping track of whether something passes the Bechdel test. This one does, because of that conversation with Joyce and Buffy, which is not about boys.
Well, I think the Joyce and Buffy conversations usually do pass the Bechdel test. I am more interested in when we get Buffy and Willow to actually pass the Bechdel test.
But this is our first episode that actually does.
Yeah.
Like, we have not actually had an episode. I don't think I counted, and I don't think I was really looking for it in the first two, but after that, it sort of put in my mind, so now I put a little thing on my notes that says, Bechdel test, did we pass? And yes or no.
I think
and
the why witch we did. It actually happens, because Buffy and Joyce talk about Buffy being on the cheerleading squad.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and the conversations with mother and daughter do tend to be less focused on boys.
Just for our listeners, like, we do bring up the Bechdel test. It's not something that I really put a lot of stock into. Basically, it's the bare minimum. Like, if you don't pass it, that's when it's, like, super glaring. It's not like you get a check mark if you do pass it. It's just like,
no, it is the bare minimum.
You got the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm probably the wrong person to talk about the Bechdel test here, but my feeling about the Bechdel test is, I think the way that people apply it to individual works is a mistaken way to apply it. I think the Bechdel test is much more meaningful and important in the fact that so few things pass the Bechdel test. It's like, a given work may or may not pass the Bechdel test, and I don't see that as inherently significant for that work. But the fact that there are so many works that can't meet that standard is the point of the Bechdel test.
Yeah. I'm just kind of keeping track for fun.
Yeah.
Also, Buffy, Buffy as an entity, as a show, as a serialized story that lasts 144 episodes, passes the Bechdel test time and time and time and time and time again.
Yeah.
It's sort of that nitty gritty of that, like, analysis. Yeah, I don't expect something like Saving Private Ryan to pass the Bechdel test, because that is actually not what that film is about, and, you know, what it's supposed to be about. But
definitely for something like Buffy, which made its bones on being so feminist, it's really interesting that there are so few episodes so far that have passed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, I mean, I think it will be interesting, certainly. I mean, I'm kind of glad you are keeping track, because I think, as I say, for an individual piece of work, it's perhaps not significant. But I think definitely by the time we get to the end of Buffy, it will be very interesting to see how well it does as an entire series.
Yeah.
As far as the Bechdel test is concerned.
Yes, I like I said, I'm keeping track. So
Good.
So I really need to bring up the character of Xander because we talk about him every week. And this episode has thus far my favorite scene of Xander, and he's not even in the scene. The scene where Giles is talking to Cordelia.
And oh, yes.
He looks at her hair and he's like, your hair. And she gets all paranoid and runs off to go fix her hair. And Giles says, Xander was right. It worked like a charm.
Yes, that was, that is a wonderful moment.
Yeah, I was like, best use of Xander, and he wasn't even in the scene.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, but it shows that Giles is listening to his young charges.
Yeah, it is, and the gelling of the group. It is.
It is.
The Scooby Gang is really starting to formulate. Yeah. So
they're starting to become a united front against everyone else, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But a question of the, you know, some of the structural problems in this episode. Why does Morgan have sit out in class? Like, I know, like, he's, you know, Sid is out so that he can look menacingly at Buffy, but what teacher would allow a student to have this dummy just on his hand while she's talking?
Yeah, I'm a little conflicted about that. I'm sort of like, I could probably come up with an explanation, but it's still weird.
Yeah, it really is.
I'm trying to think of when I worked with kids a little younger and around this age, and I don't know. If someone has an object that obviously brings them happiness, you know what I mean? Like a comfort object, you know?
Yeah.
It's when it becomes disruptive, right? But mm-hmm. if I was just like a teacher and this like kind of kooky kid is like, no, I really prefer to sit here with my dummy, I'd be like, yeah, all right, whatevs. Please don't disrupt my class. And
being right. that I was in high school during this time, I can say that most teachers probably wouldn't let that fly. It was, you know, it just really stuck out to me that would have been you got to put that away.
I'm guessing she's just a holdover from the Flutie administration.
Fair enough.
is she going to get eaten?
I don't know. I do we ever see her again? No, I don't think so.
I think she's a woolly-headed liberal. Uh-oh.
Yep.
I might be getting eaten myself.
And, you know, another great the scene with Xander and Sid.
Yes.
It's great.
Yeah, he is obnoxious, but he is obnoxious in the I'm a goofy teenage boy way, which is the perfectly fine way for Xander to be obnoxious.
And apparently the...
Mostly, yeah. I do have one problem with that scene. Is his total insensitivity to Buffy's feelings on this.
I have notes about that from all of them, actually, yeah.
Well, they're also disbelieving of Buffy, and it's like, every episode up until this point, Buffy's been right.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the line that in the on the DVD set, when it goes into the episode... Because each episode, when you go from the menu into the episode, it has like this transitional frame, and then a quote, a line from the episode over the thing. And the one for this episode contains the line, "I'm not just some crazy person; I'm the Slayer."
Yeah. Though, I mean, I have to say, I'm kind of okay with what Xander did, just because he has Sid in his lap at the moment. He's got his hand up Sid. It's like, the whole reason why he stole Sid was, one, to give Buffy a chance to talk to Morgan, but also to show Buffy it's like, Sid's just a dummy. Granted, we find out later that, you know, Sid is not just a dummy.
Right.
But for all intents and purposes, he seems to be one, so I can kind of, you know, let Xander away with the whole him whole being obnoxious. And also, it was so funny, and it was, most of it was ad-libbed by Nikki.
Right, so. I was going to say, especially the red rum was totally an ad-lib.
Yes.
And, but yeah, the whole team, though, it's still bothering me, and I'm putting in my notes every week. It's like, time and time again, you've seen Buffy be right. And yes, you're continuing to question sort of her wisdom. So my permanent hashtag for this is don't Scully me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's time to sort of go, well, you know, for the last several weeks, every time there's been an issue, Buffy's been able to figure it out. And we gave her an awful lot of shit for that. Maybe we should stop doing that.
Yeah.
You know.
Unfortunately, yeah. I do think the Buffy being right in every episode is something that's going to start to peter off. It is very much present in the first season, but later on, it doesn't turn up quite as much. It's still there, but they do kind of tweak the character so that she is more of the, I'm going to fight things, and everybody else is going to take care of the research and everything, so.
Yes, but I think there are many times in this show where Buffy is absolutely right because it's an intuition, it's a feeling, and they Buffy gets a little gaslighted in some of these episodes where she's like, no, I know this is what this is.
Yeah.
And they just, I don't know, for some reason or another, just can't believe that she may actually know what she's talking about and have that, not just intuition, like that deep Slayer connection to the Force's intuition that the rest of them don't have. So,
one thing we haven't talked about a lot yet is the actual how Sid is done. And I was actually fairly impressed by the way they did Sid. Because, I mean, he doesn't look great, but he looks as good as he should look for being a ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah, he looks appropriately good.
Yeah. And, like, the fight scene between Sid and Buffy, I like how they handled this, where they handicapped Buffy so that it could be an actual fight. And they do a lot of close-ups on Sid so that they don't need to really manipulate the puppet a lot. But it also makes things feel a lot more claustrophobic, like Buffy is, you know, held down at the time. So, yeah.
Joss even comments in the interview that, you know, that they trapped Buffy to make it a fair fight, essentially. Oh, yeah.
They had to do it. I mean, there was no other way that the fight would work. Otherwise, Buffy would just, I mean, there's the episode in, I think it's season 4, when Buffy squishes the tiny fear demon.
Yeah, yes, yes.
I have a fear demon. I have a tiny fear demon from a set of... I have a little Gacknor, and I actually keep him with my, like, calming meditation crystals to, like, remind me that fear really is only as big as Gacknor.
Aw.
Yes, another instance of Buffy being a touchstone for me in my psychological screwed-upness.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to play off my geekiness, where it's like, I think it's season 4, but then it's like, it's Gacknor. That's the name of the demon.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think I'm pretty sure it is season 4, actually.
It is. It's the episode Fear itself. Yeah.
It has to be, because Dawn's not involved.
Yeah, no, Oz is still
around. And they're
around.
In college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
the Halloween episode of season 4, Fear itself, with I am Gacknor.
Yes.
There you go.
We will get to that eventually, several years from now. And everybody's expressions when they finally find out the truth about Sid. I love it.
Yeah.
I really like the when they start, Buffy and Sid start interrogating each other. It's like, no, you. And it's this very parody of a hard-boiled detective dialogue.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which I think works so well with Sid's particular voice.
Yeah.
Yes.
And his particular time period. Very, he's like a hard-boiled 1930s detective demon hunter turned into a puppet.
Did they ever do any, like, story about Sid, like, as, like, a human demon hunter, like, in Tales from the Slayer or anything like that?
I don't think they did.
That's a missed opportunity, I think.
That is a shame. It would be really nice to see, like, a, you know, old Tales of Sid story somewhere.
And I mean, of course, like, Sid talks about how he, you know, had some good times with the Slayer.
Yeah.
He does show up in the second Buffy video game.
Chaos Bleeds, yeah.
Yeah, which I actually have a copy of on my shelf.
I have it too. It's a great game.
I didn't like that one as much as the first game. I enjoyed that one a little better.
I never played the first one. I only played
Chaos I love Bleeds, the first one. It's fantastic.
Chaos Bleeds was a really good game.
Yeah. I Yeah, I have both of them, and I prefer the other one, but I do know that Sizz does show up in Chaos Blades.
Yeah, so. I think the first one was only for Xbox, and I never had Xbox, so...
I had an Xbox, so, you know, that's why...
Chaos Blades did come out for PlayStation, so...
I bought an Xbox just so I could play that game.
Aw, you're such a nerd!
Really? I never heard that before! I'm a nerd? Really? Tell me more about that.
Oh, come on. We're not nerds. We're doing a Buffy podcast. We're clearly not nerds.
Clearly not. We are clearly the coolest kids in school and always were.
Yeah. Dude, I have notes here about Oedipus Rex, so, yeah.
Oh, I have a note saying how much I remember the stupid power circle.
Like, oh, God.
Form the power circle, and Giles doesn't know what the power circle is. I'm like, oh, the power circle.
Yeah.
Because not only are you a nerd, you're a theater nerd.
A former theater nerd, yes.
Okay.
Oh, it never goes away.
It never really goes away, no.
But my favorite thing about the power circle, though, is Giles gathers everybody and then just goes, okay. And they're all like, what?
Here's the other. You were going to talk about Oedipus.
I can bring that up at the end of the episode, but I just said that I do have notes about it. So just to show you that, you know, when I mention that, you know, you're a nerd, that's what we call hypocritical humor.
I know. And I was teasing. I was being mock offended. Yes. So here's what the other thing I wanted to talk about. Giles is not at all interested in being the librarian.
No, he's not. He's
like
only
he
there
has
because
no
of Buffy.
interest in what his actual job is. And I'm like, well, then why does he need the cover?
I guess
it's so he can justify hanging out with a teenage girl.
Well, he does like books.
Oh, well, he loves books. I'm sure he'd be really happy being a librarian at not a high school.
Well, no, I'm sure he'd be happy being a librarian at a library that no one ever comes into.
He is a librarian at a library that nobody ever comes into. I think there's an episode in the second season where Jonathan comes into the library and Xander and Giles are like super shocked that there's somebody in there.
Yeah, well, that's sort of almost a running joke, is like when anyone other than the Scooby Gang comes into the library, they just look at them like they must be lost.
Yeah.
Right, but he obviously... So I guess my little headcanon for this is, like, any other Slayer, he would not have had to take this cover job.
No, he wouldn't.
Right, because she would have been identified early on, taken from her family, trained with... you know, that watcher and done the thing, but I guess he needs this sort of, you know, excuse to be there. Mm-hmm. And also it's an excuse for the writers to integrate him into their everyday lives.
I mean, of course, we can also possibly use, like, headcanon it that Giles is, like, right over the Hellmouth. Like, the Hellmouth opens up in that library.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So, good point.
Yeah, he can, like, almost be, like, the guardian of the Hellmouth. And actually, that was something that they were going to introduce into Angel Season 5, had they been able to get Anthony Stewart Head. They were going to have Giles be guarding the Deeper Well. So, basically, but yeah, they couldn't get Anthony Stewart Head, so then they introduced the character of Drogon. So basically, Giles can almost be serving as the guardian of the Hellmouth while he's, you know, as the librarian. So
A lot of sense. That you know, sort of clears up. But yeah, he doesn't want to be a
Like this is total really headcanon. The only reason he is there is because they need him to be there because everything happens at the high school.
Well, right, also, absolutely. Also, I'm thinking from the perspective of the Watchers Council. Like, the last time they sent a traditional watcher to watch over Buffy, he got killed.
Yeah, that is true.
So they probably thought, like, we need to do something different here.
It also probably helps keep the cost of Giles down, because they do mention over on Angel that all the alchemists on the board, and they still make us fly coach. So the Watcher's Council is notoriously cheap. So if they can get Giles to pull in an extra paycheck, I'm sure they appreciate it.
Which, you know, I was thinking about this the other day with the Giles and the cover story. You know, Buffy had an original Watcher, which is like, it's canon adjacent because they did the origin comic, but...
They have the origin comic, and they do show Merrick briefly in
Which I guess we'll talk about it when we get to Becoming, but yeah. I'm like, is that the only American Watcher we ever see? We'll get there later.
Yeah.
Put a pin in that, Andy, and remind me, guys, that I would like to talk about that.
There are American Watchers. I don't think we particularly see them. Wesley was supposed to be an American Watcher originally, but I guess Joss just really liked Alexis's British accent. His not real British accent.
Yeah, but his British accent is way better than his natural accent. Like his...
That's true.
I'm rewatching Dollhouse right now, and I'm sorry, Alexis's natural speaking voice is... It's nasal, but it's nasal, and it's not very nice. And as Wesley, I'm like, all right, talk to me all day. So, you know, whatever.
The Watcher Harris Yulin plays... In now I'm forgetting the name of the episode. It should be obvious. The one where they test helpless. Yes, is he American? Because Harris Yulin certainly is.
I think he is. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll get. Yeah.
Now, I mean, we're a ways off.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. I think most of the Watchers we've seen have been British, but I don't think that it is. You know, a certainty.
And given the origins of the Slayer and the Watchers, it's kind of funny that they're British.
Well, that's, yeah, I think it's mostly because of Joss's Anglophilia.
Well, yeah. Oh, you want to talk about real world reasons? Fine.
Sorry, we get meta around here.
That's okay.
Since we've been talking about Giles, I think one of the highlights of this episode is seeing Giles in a cardigan.
Oh my god, I have it in my notes! It says, and also Giles in that shawl collar sweater. Oh dear me, my loins.
Sorry, David.
No, that's fine. I'm used to it by now. Yeah, that's fine.
This is your weekly edition of Andy Lusts After Giles.
Andy and MC. Because I have same note.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
It's nice. I mean, this is the first time we've seen him kind of not in all of the tweed, which we will see more of coming up in later seasons. But it was like, oh, he still looks so British because he's wearing a cardigan. But
it's... Yeah. And one of them is really pretty chic. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. The other one is very Mr. Rogers. There's a brownish tan one that comes up later in the episode.
Yeah.
And they don't do that again for a while.
Yeah.
They stick him back in the tweed until...
I think until the Dark Ages.
Yes, until Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would just want to warn you, I expect you to cut me some slack when we hit the wish.
You mean the willow and the leather?
Yes.
I'm going to be right there with you.
Okay, that, good.
Yeah. Allie Hannigan made me realize things about myself. Oh.
I adore Willow. I don't go on about it all that often, but I make no secret about my absolute crush on Willow.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's going to be so hard when I start talking about how I really hate Willow in later seasons.
She's problematic in the later seasons. I still have a crush on her, but yeah, there are issues.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, then, yes,
there are people in life who I love dearly, but they have issues. It's, you know.
Yeah, I know. Allison Hannigan is really good looking. Very cute.
And Willow is just adorable. So I guess, are we up to final thoughts? Or
well,
I have a couple of random things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just for the end scene, I mean, we have already talked about it. I really loved how just everybody's contributing to that last fight. Other than Giles.
Oh, yeah. Well, he is tied up at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I do have yay for Xander saving Giles's beautiful head.
Yes.
It was really strange, but when Cid stabs the Mark demon, it's the vamp dusting sound effect.
Mm. It really stood out to me.
That is like, wow, that's what it sounds like when they dust the vamps. And then, of course, we get the ending. You know, I don't get it. What is it? Avant-garde?
Avant-garde?
That is wonderful. That is...
It actually made me think of several plays I've been in over the years, speaking of the theater geek, where my parents went, well, that was something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite get it, but you were real good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even here, even on the podcast here, we've definitely gone to like, yep, that was an episode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Well, but most of those shows that I was in, I was like super proud of, and they made sense to me and the other people that saw it. It was just my friends, my parents going, that was a bit avant-garde. Mm-hmm. And I know that my parents have used that word about some of the projects I've done is, it was a bit avant-garde, honey. We didn't quite get that.
Mm-hmm.
But anything that wasn't musical theater was a little bit avant-garde.
So, right.
You know.
And so, then we get the actual end of the episode.
One of the greatest scenes ever on Buffy.
Yeah, it is the only time they have ever done a an end credit sequence. And it's so good. I mean, I think the reason why they didn't do it more after this is because they showed it once on the WB, and every time they reran it, they didn't re-show it. It didn't show up again until it was on DVD.
But Joss mentions that in the interview.
Yeah.
He also mentions it was the hardest thing they ever shot, because basically no one could stop laughing.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. Joss on the season 7 DVD actually made a comment about it. The network hated it. And the note said, we realize that it's Shakespeare, but does he have to talk about sleeping with his mother?
We realize that it's Shakespeare?
Oedipus Rex is not at all Shakespeare. It was written about 2,000 years before Shakespeare was born.
Oh, kill me now. Oh.
Yeah. I think it's perfect. Like, what they chose to do was amazing, and it's so badly acted. And acting bad for actors is not the easiest thing to do.
It's not. I remember, I think it's on a commentary, a documentary on Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Which is one of my favorite films. Mm. And it's Julianne Moore talking about how absolutely hard it was to be a bad actor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because, you know, when they're shooting the porno scenes in Boogie Nights, they all have to be bad porno actors. Yeah. And they had a contest to see who could do the worst acting.
Yeah.
And she said it was something about holding your hands. There's a certain way novice actors have of holding their hands and not knowing what to do with them. That was sort of her key into that. So, yeah, bad acting is really hard for a decent actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, we get the wonderful little ad-lib from Allie Hannigan at the end where she runs off the stage.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. My favorite, though, is Sarah in that she's like, oh, Oedipus, I have it, like...
Yeah,
Xander's at least trying.
He really is.
He is trying just a little bit, which kind of matches with Xander's character.
Yeah, there's a bit too much, actually.
Yeah.
Well, he was like, well, I might actually enjoy this acting thing, so I'll actually try to. And Buffy's like, I ain't having it. And Willow, especially at this point in her growth and development, is like, nope, I'm out. I'm noping out of this. Because we see throughout the course of the series, actually, that character through line goes through.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. She has the dream about...
come up in the next episode.
It will. And then even going up into Restless in season 4. Yeah.
Yep.
And her fear of the fact that she has to be in this play without knowing her lines,
But then if I remember correctly, in season 5, she actually talks about taking a drama class. Or
it's season four where she's thinking about taking a drama class, oh, okay. and then it shows up in Restless.
Okay.
That she takes this drama class that she's never actually been to.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I have to say this whole thing makes me feel very special that I'm one of the relatively few people who has actually seen Allison Hannigan on stage.
Oh really?
Yes, believe it or not, for some reason someone decided to adapt When Harry Met Sally a play. And this only, as far as I know, it only played in England. It did not come to the States. And it starred Allison Hannigan and Luke Perry.
Oh, God.
So a sort of Buffy mashup here.
Yeah.
And it was not terrible. It was pointless because there was no reason to, like, if right. you were to remake that movie, I'd have the same feeling. It's like, why?
Yeah.
But I mean, she was fine.
just fine. Yeah. It was just sort of,
wasn't a lot to work with, to be honest.
Right.
Yeah. It's, you know.
And Luke, and how is Luke Perry?
He was fine.
He was Luke Perry.
It was a perfectly enjoyable play. It was nothing special. It was good. But it was not, like, all that, by any means.
It's a romantic comedy, it's one of the greatest romantic comedies ever made.
I think whoever adapted it to stage just didn't do that good a job of adapting it to stage, really, is the problem.
And that's just not the kind of movie that I think works on stage. There's
exactly.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, that's cool that you got to see
both of them. I was in England when it was playing, and I was like, oh, I have to go see this. So.
That's awesome. Well, when you're able to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but you're the one that saw Benedict Cumberbatch in Hamlet. In
yeah,
the UK,
I did.
So
I saw it twice.
Yeah, you're one to talk, Missy.
Yeah.
I didn't see that live. I saw it broadcast. But
me too.
Yeah, I saw it live twice, and I got to meet him afterwards.
Fine.
but I haven't met anybody from the. Well, no, actually, that's not true. I've met a couple of the Buffy people, like at conventions and stuff.
Yeah, I've met Nikki quite a few times. Yeah. I think I've talked about that before. I actually have a picture of him here, and he squeezed my back fat. I'll keep reminding you guys of that. So this whole podcast is about Nikki Brendon has touched my back fat.
So
it was wonderful.
Well, we have kind of, I think, agreed that this episode was, you know, all right.
Yeah, even maybe good. Just
I like it a lot.
With a couple of problems.
Yeah, though we are actually quite alone in that summation of it. This is the lowest rated episode of Buffy in the entire series. It got one point seven million households watching it. It was not a popular episode.
I remember trying to introduce a friend of mine into Buffy. And I think she did get into it eventually, because it's when those VHS sets were coming out.
Yeah.
And this was one of the ones on the VHS sets, and she refused to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, nope. No, it's got a dummy. I'm not doing it. Forget it. I'm not doing it. No, we got her through to, I think we got her watching in season three, and then we caught her up pretty well between the videotapes, and then I had a friend that taped them all, because he was obsessed as I was, am still. And we got her caught up, and she became a huge fan, but she refused to watch this episode because of the ventriloquist dummy.
Obviously, this is not the first possessed or demonic or whatever ventriloquist dummy storyline ever. I mean, obviously,
there's a ton of
the Anthony Hopkins magic is, you know, a classic scary as hell talking dummy thing. And
with my age, I immediately go R.L. Stein, Night of the Living Dummy. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if I have a dummy movie in my age bracket.
Well, yeah, mine isn't a dummy movie. Mine classic. Is a book, and then the Goosebumps TV show. So.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting is this is the only one I can think of where the dummy actually turns out not to be evil.
That's probably why they did it.
Yes.
They wanted to subvert the genre.
That is probably true.
Yeah, so it was definitely, it's even more than usual, it was a subversion of the genre. Yeah. Because, I mean, I literally cannot think of another example.
Yeah. I can't either.
So this episode, I think, wins for best translated episode title. Because I found a couple of the translations for it. I mean, most of them are pretty standard. It's like The Puppet or The Puppet Show. But the German one, I will not read the German because I don't know how to speak German. But it translates to Buffy Lets the Puppets Dance.
Ooh!
That's so German.
I love it.
That is so ridiculously German. I love it.
It's like, this is the best. I love it so much.
Yeah. Even in English, that's German.
Yeah.
So, well, for any sure. final, like, last-minute things on this episode?
Yeah, I had like, two, you know, nitpicky things. They talk about how, you know, he killed a demon, there was a curse, now I'm a puppet.
Yeah.
They don't really make it clear that the demon in question was one of the seven, or why one of them would have cursed him.
Hmm.
Huh. And so my note was, what is the relationship between killing the seventh demon and lifting the puppet curse?
I thought it was one of the seven demons.
I mean, obviously that is a possible explanation, but the way it's written doesn't really make that clear.
Mm-hmm.
So again, note to 20 years ago Buffy writers, like, clean that up. My other thing, though, is when the talent show is about to start, and when Cordy comes in and has the thing with Giles, and Giles says, picture everyone in their underwear, and, you know, that whole thing. When that conversation ends, Giles heads up the stairs, and there is a girl playing the violin. Except she's, and you can hear the violin being played. She appears to be actually just rubbing the bow against the side of the violin, not actually touching any of the strings. And
it's
avant-garde. I guess I'm looking at that. I'm just like, I don't get it. It must be avant-garde. I honestly had no idea what they were thinking when they shot that.
I think what they were thinking was they hired an actress who couldn't play the violin, and it's like, please don't touch the strings.
I guess that's it.
I never noticed that.
You go back and look at it, it just looks really weird.
Okay.
So those are my traditional nitpicky things.
Well, I think that's, you know, our roles, much like the Scoobies, are getting solidified here on the podcast, and yours is nitpicker.
Oh yes, no question.
That. And mine is lusting for Giles.
And pointing out all of the problematic things with Xander.
I think you and I share those roles. That's our job. Yeah, that's like a co-Judy kind of thing.
Okay, so do you have any final...
I don't. Overall, I think it's a really fun episode, and it's not one I skip upon rewatch.
Yeah, it's a nice, fun little one-shot. So next time, we'll be reviewing Nightmares, which will be, I think, another interesting one to go over. So until then, grr, arg.
I'd like to thank everyone who downloaded the podcast, and an extra special thanks to everyone who shared, liked, and subscribed on social media. If you'd like your questions or comments read on the show, you can contact us on our website, returntothehellmouth.com, on YouTube at Return to the Hellmouth, on Tumblr and Facebook at Return to the Hellmouth, or on Twitter at Hellmouth Return, or on email at returntothehellmouth@gmail.com. We'll be sure to read your comments on the show. Be sure to rate our show at iTunes and Stitcher. Also check out MC's YouTube channel. See you on Tuesday for Nightmares.
Grr. Arg.